Hi folks, how are you? Hope you've had a good week and welcome along to another episode of my podcast, Soundtracking. I'm actually just back from a 2-week road trip around the homeland, visiting places and parts of Scotland that I've never been to. Places like Cambus Darragh and Mallaig and the Isle of Skye, Flodigarry. Oh, it was extraordinary. And the wonderful thing was that I felt like really inspired by lots of places, and it reminded me of lots of films along the way. So if anybody follows me on Instagram, they'll have seen me reciting various kind of film quotes or soundtracks or reminiscing about films from different parts that I've encountered on the road trip. But I literally just landed back home. Took slightly longer than expected. Be careful out there, folks, on the roads if you are touring around for your holidays. It's lovely to be back. We've got loads of exciting stuff coming up for you over the next few weeks on the podcast. And this week is particularly exciting. It's a triple header on this week's Soundtracking, as I'm joined first by friend of the show, the lovely Edgar Wright, to discuss his first foray into documentary filmmaking, The Sparks Brothers. And then by Russell and Ron themselves. Can you hear the giddiness in my voice? The groundbreaking duo who've been breaking the mould for, close to half a century, really. Decades. Now, as well as getting the lowdown on his doc from Edgar, Russell and Ron, we also find out about Annette, the screen musical written by the brothers, which stars Adam Driver and Marion Cotillard and was directed by Lewis Carax. It recently showed at Cannes Film Festival to, well, a lot of very good reviews. I've seen it. I loved it. More on that later. But before all that, a word from our very dear friends at Grass & Co. Now, Grass & Co. are a premium CBD range of the finest quality, sustainably sourced and blended with complementary botanical ingredients like chamomile, ginger, turmeric and ashwagandha, which not only make it taste lovely, but also help relax your mind and soothe your body. And we could all do with a little bit of that right now. Now, I want to make a few things clear. For some of you who might not be aware of what CBD is and its benefits, CBD stands for cannabidiol, which is a natural extract of the hemp plant, and it's both legal and non-intoxicating. Now, as regular listeners to the show will know, I am a genuine fan of this brand. Why do I use it? Well, to make the day a little bit easier. I find it helps with lots of things, anxiety, stress, and definitely sleeping. So maybe now's the time for you to give CBD a go. And if so, I can highly recommend the Grass & Co. products. Now, there are three ranges: Calm, Rest and Ease, and I'm particularly fond of the Calm range, which also comes with complementary products like aromatherapy candles, pillow spray, or great for any muscle issues, their CBD balm. They're all there to help you with your daily routine, bringing a touch of tranquility to whatever lays ahead for you. Grass & Co. CBD oils contain no trace of THC, and all the CBD products are totally legal to buy, consume and supply in the UK. Interested? Then find your Calm with 25% off plus free shipping. That's at grassandco.com/sound. So visit grassandco.com/sound and use the discount code sound at checkout to claim 25% off the entire Grass & Co. ranges. And so to Edgar, before we then hear from the Sparks Brothers themselves. And we'll begin with the title track from one of Edgar's favourite albums, Angst in My Pants.
I hope it doesn't show, it'll go away. It's just a passing phase, it'll go away. You can't just go.
Hi.
I do have a puppy in the room.
only thing that could go wrong is if somebody comes to the door, which they sometimes do, he does
go... goes batshit crazy. That's all right. No worries. How are you?
I'm good.
Awesome.
I just found out that my documentary is showing at the Cannes Film Festival tomorrow and I can't go. But apart from that, I'm fine. I mean, what a weird year. I've now had this film in the Sundance Film Festival, which didn't have a physical screening. And then they just suddenly announced that it was showing tomorrow at Cannes. And I was like, oh, I can't be there, guys. Oh, well.
Can you be there? Can they kind of create what about an Edgar Wright hologram to appear on stage?
I'm sure I could zoom in, but I actually thought that because Ron and Russell are going to be there, it might be funnier if they just read something out from me.
Yeah.
Just an intro. It's not like there's a Q&A or anything, but it's fine. I've come to terms with it.
I was really nervous about chatting to them this morning. I don't know why. I think it's because they're just like, they're sparks and they're awesome and cool. And but they were so, so lovely. I had such a lovely chat with them this morning.
Yeah. I mean, are we going now? Because I could tell you a story about when we first met.
Yeah, if you want to tell me that story. I mean, it's, yeah.
Well, I mean, I felt a similar way. I know what you mean about meeting Ron and Russell. The irony is that they're like the nicest guys in rock. But because they're sparks, like growing up, people like David Bowie, R.I.P., or Kate Bush, or Sparks, they feel like they're not on planet Earth. You don't feel that they exist in the same world as you. So it's always a bit strange, the idea that they might be mortal beings. And how this started to come about is partly because of this, is that we can talk about how I got into Sparks, but I guess in more recent years I've become like a full-on evangelist for Sparks, in the sense that anybody that was within my earshot, if they hadn't heard Sparks, I would put Sparks on. And that happened like about 6 years ago when I was writing Baby Driver in LA. My friend Michael Bacall, the screenwriter of 21 Jump Street, he was helping me out for a day. And, you know, I just said, hey, I mean, it was after FFS had just come out, the Franz Ferdinand Sparks album. Mm-hmm. And I said, hey, do you know any Sparks? And he only knew one song, All I Ever Think About Is Sex, which was something that he'd heard on a compilation tape and never heard another Sparks song. So as soon as I heard that, I was like, oh my God, let me play some Sparks. So I was playing him Kimono My House, you know, Number One in Heaven, the album, FFS and other ones. And then 3 albums in, I sort of thought aloud something which I probably should have thought of years before. I thought, oh, I wonder if Sparks are on Twitter. And again, you just think that like Sparks are too, maybe they're too cool to be on Twitter.
Yeah.
So I found their page and it said, Sparks follows you. And I was like, oh my God, like Sparks with me? And I felt like a dummy that I had not been following them in the first place. So number one, I followed them back. Hey, is this really the band or like management? Because I'm such a huge fan. And Russell replied and said, no, this is Russell. We're big fans of your movies. And I said, wow, that's amazing. I love all your work, loving FFS. They said, where are you based? I said, I'm in Los Angeles at the moment. They said, well, we live in Los Angeles. I said, I'm flying in a couple of days. Maybe we could get breakfast or something. And they said, let's do that. So like then within like 32 hours, I'm sitting opposite Ron and Russell for breakfast at Russell's house. And again, like sort of, so I'd known who they were since I was 5 years old, and just sitting opposite them. I mean, you interviewed them earlier, but there is that thing where they're sort of like the fact that they're so nice and normal seems to make it extra weird. Yeah. It's just like they're very enigmatic, but they're sort of enigmatic in how normal they are, because they don't let you down like some of your favorite artists when you meet them in person. They say never meet your heroes. Sparks are not like that, because I think, and maybe the documentary bears this out, is that the line between Ron and Russell and Sparks has become permanently blurred over the years. And their kind of total devotion to being Sparks and working constantly, if they're not touring, they're working, whether it's on a new Sparks album or like an opera, right? Or
yeah,
like whatever, you know, like, and so I was sort of keenly aware of this, getting to know them a little bit. And there was also that thing that was like, there wasn't a nagging thing in me that there was that I thought that there was anything, you know, dark and mysterious behind the curtain. It was more that I was like really beguiled by the fact that they had this almost monastic approach to being Sparks, in terms of that they had their blinkers on and they're kind of in this bubble just being Sparks and writing mm-hmm. Sparks music. And it was different because when you meet, when you know rock stars, you're married to one, you know, like, so like you know, sometimes when you meet rock stars, they're off the clock, and it's sort of like somehow like less interesting because they're not, like, when you meet them, they're not working. But Sparks always seem to be working all the time.
Yeah.
And I was really sort of taken by that. And also there were little things as well that I thought were amusing. Number one was that I started to think they don't live together, but there's definitely like a feeling that they're like Rox, Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street, in terms of they seem sort of permanently joined at the hip, in the sense, and this is true, this is before the age of Zoom, but I've seen Russell without Ron twice, but I have never seen Ron without Russell. And there's just a thing where they're not identical twins, but they sort of always be kind of coordinated in what they're wearing. They've known each other. You know, there's a joke in the film, is like, how did you first meet? We're brothers. But like, they know when to answer. They don't talk over each other. They're also, unusually for brothers in rock, in comparison to, say, Noel and Liam Gallagher, or like Ray and Dave Davis, or yeah, like Everly Brothers, or like Barry and Robin Gibb when Robin mm-hmm. was still alive, they're not in competition to be the star. They know what each other can do, and they're kind of comfortable with that. Is that, like, Ron has no aspirations, as he says in the documentary, to be the lead, and Russell sort of, you know, sort of defers to his older brother Ron. So they kind of have, seemingly, as far as I can see, and as far as everybody else that's worked with them, a very healthy approach. And I mean, they've said themselves that if they weren't brothers, they would never have done 25 albums together. So there's obviously this kind of like strong sort of bond and shared sense of humor and sensibility. I mean, they're also, it's funny, it's not in the documentary, but Flea said something. It's not in the documentary, but it is in the documentary actors. But he said that they're like the Coen brothers of rock. Joel and Ethan Coen, like, Joel kind of takes the director credit and Ethan takes the producer credit, and they share writing credit, but essentially they do everything together. Mm-hmm. And so that's just kind of like an agreement they have. And there's a sense with Sparks, like in recent years, they share all songwriting credits because, you know, mostly Ron writes the lyrics, but Russell has written a lot of lyrics as well. And more recently, they just have a thing where it's just shared credit as Sparks. And that's what, you know, Annette is as well. And I just think they obviously just kind of have a really sort of healthy outlook on how to be in each other's pockets for like, yeah, 70 years.
I love the fact that within 32 hours, not only are you going for breakfast with them, but round to Russell's house, which is amazing. Not like to Soho House or something. That's amazing. At which point I would clearly be trying to get as much information as I could about them, looking at libraries, what do they watch, what do they listen to, all that kind of stuff would be my first kind of protocol when I get there to the house. I wonder if you would say.
Well, it sort of came up organically in conversation. The sort of first thing that I realised about them is that they're massive film geeks. And so there was an element where I sort of, and you know, I don't mean to kind of like put words into their mouth, but I sort of felt, oh, I feel like we would have been friends if we'd have been at college. We're into all the same things. And so that was really nice because they knew all my films and stuff, and that was very flattering.
So
and
cool.
I did tell them, which was kind of, I sort of had to tell them, but it was true. It's like, you know, because some people have said when I've been doing this press tour, said, oh, you've never used a Spark song in any of your movies. And I said, well, there's a good reason for that. It's that I did try and put This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us into Hot Fuzz. And in the scene where Timothy Dalton and Simon Pegg are fighting in a model village, This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us in a model village, it makes sense. However, Sparks, and this is like a compliment to them. Sparks are not background music. Sparks sort of demand undivided attention. And it's mostly not just the music itself, but the lyrical content. When you're listening to a Spark song, and this is something that, like, for a lot of people is part of the obsession, and maybe for the more mainstream AOR listener who wants to just listen to Radio One and not have to eat their vegetables, there is an element of Spark sometimes when people think, wait, what is this song about? Because sometimes you're listening to a song and then you're thinking, there's something going on with these lyrics that I don't understand. And Neil Gaiman talks about it in the movie, like, he was convinced that many of the songs were filthy and sort of decided to try and decode them like Chaucer poem. So there's an element where, like, I think sort of like somebody says in the documentary, that Sparks cannot be fully, you can enjoy the music, but they can't be fully appreciated at face value because they don't always, in their lyrical content, do the easiest subject matter, or usually it's subject matter that once you start to analyze it like a great poem, it's like, oh yeah, this makes sense. When you first listen to This Town Ain't Big Enough for the Both of Us, it's like the onslaught of the kind of the full-on operatic style is just like incredibly like engaging and diverting. And then it's like maybe after like several listens or maybe even years, you think, wait, what is this song about? And then you start to read the lyrics and then it's like, oh, okay. So it's about, it's a song that's about a man trying to go on a date in a town where there are more men than women. This town ain't big enough for the both of us. At some point, it's going to end up in a showdown because there are not enough dates to go around. And then on top of that, the narrator of the song is so kind of like stricken with anxiety about getting a date that he seems to imagine these nightmare scenarios which would stop him from having a date: a plane crash, a bomb, cannibals attacking. And then you think, this was a number two hit. Like, most people listen to that song and they know the music and how to hum it and they know the chorus. I feel that's one of the reasons why so many people wanted to talk about them. Why, if they weren't as massive as like Queen were in the day, you know, a band who supported them on their first UK tour, Queen supported Sparks, you know, it's because like, so Queen would probably find more kind of like direct ways to be emotional in a way that anybody can understand the song, Find Me Somebody to Love. Sparks are sort of kind of always in the, and I think in a heroic way, making it difficult for themselves by doing songs where you listen to it and you enjoy the tune, then you're thinking, wait, what is he singing about? Is it dirty? Is Amateur Hour really dirty? Like, Never Turn Your Back on Mother Earth about the dangers of like destroying the planet, or is it about the fact that the earth is a brutal mistress that will kill you with when your back is turned? And it's the latter.
Yeah, well, it's a clever thing that they do where they almost have like levels of intensity for depending on what type of fan you are. So whether you are a kind of surface level, oh, I'm just going to enjoy the tune and have a dance and sing along with the chorus, or whether you want to go deep, they almost kind of give you different levels of fandom that you can have with them, with their songwriting.
I honestly think that one of the reasons that Sparks have got such longevity is, number one, they kept making great new music, unlike a lot of their peers. You know, a lot of bands who, and it's partly because they haven't had the same mainstream success as some of those other bands, is they've never sort of really had a chance to rest on their laurels, and they don't want to. You know, bands like The Who or The Rolling Stones have been going for like 6 decades. You know, at a certain point, they're just doing a greatest hits tour forever. And Sparks have sort of never really done that. They rarely look back. It's partly because they sort of like, they've still got something to prove. And then the other part of it, I think, is why people obsess about them and they have a growing fan base, is because there's a lot to unpack in what they look like, in the album covers, in the lyrics, in the music. It's like other bands that maybe were like enormous in the 70s, like the Eagles. You know, they're great, but there's absolutely nothing to say about them beyond like listening to the song.
They're also stuck in that era, though. That's the thing, like with the Eagles, they're stuck in that era, whereas Sparks are this kind of constantly almost like regenerating kind of brilliant creative thing that even though they try different things, it's never so stuck in that moment that it doesn't feel relevant 20 years later. I think that's the one of the many brilliant things about them.
I think it's also the reason why it doesn't seem to me that they've ever been had the time to be bitter about bands that have been influenced by them doing so much better than them, because they've already moved on themselves.
Yeah.
Like if you were like sort of like doing the glam rock sound and then like a T-Rex, you kind of kept doing the same thing, and then Queen come along and sort of take elements of that and become, and I love Queen, by the way. I'm not saying that Queen or the Sparks were pop, but there's definitely like similarities when you listen to the first couple of albums to the first couple of Queen albums. But then Queen has sort of synthesized that into something else. But Sparks don't have any time to be bitter about it, because in that time themselves, they're already like three genres on. You know, they've already like moved on like four paces and doing something else, and the glam rock thing is not interesting to them either. They're already like doing a proto punk album, or they're doing
an opera,
or they're doing like, you know, the Giorgio Moroder album from 1979, Number One in Heaven, is like them as a synth pop duo 2 years before like Soft Cell, 2 years before Depeche Mode, you know, several years before the Pet Shop Boys and Yazoo, and it's like, and they sort of created the template for that, not just the music but aesthetically. What a Top of the Pops performance. You know, they basically predicted most of Top of the Pops in the 80s in
1979. What you've managed to do is that I feel like I learned so much about them as a band and as individuals and their journey, but there's still an enigma around them. And I love that it's so clever. I don't know how you've been able to do that, but you have kind of almost sort of allowed us to explore so much about them, but still kept a sort of curtain of enigma around them, which is so important, I think, because that's part of, I think, what's so wonderful about them.
Well, I think that was a kind of like, there was a twofold thing to that, is that it's something which, you know, like they're a band that fans hold very dear to them. And some of them would like to think this is my thing. And I'm glad it's not bigger than it is, because this is my thing. On the flip side, most of those fans would also agree is like, these guys deserve more accolades than they have. Not that they haven't been successful through the years, because they have, but still, part of the reason that I wanted to make the movie is I felt like this was the best, most influential band that did not have a documentary about them. And I felt at a certain point, I've seen documentaries about bands that I think are a tenth as good as Sparks. Why don't Sparks have a documentary? So in a weird way, that's how the documentary came about, because I kept saying out loud without thinking who that person would be, saying, somebody should do a documentary about Sparks. Like, oh my God, like they've got such an amazing story, so influential, got so many kind of famous fans who would kind of like go on record saying that Sparks influenced them. Why isn't somebody doing a Sparks documentary? And when I was at a Sparks gig in 2017 with Phil Lord, director of the Lego Movie and 21 Jump Street and others, I was saying this spiel to him, saying like, the only thing stopping Sparks from being as big as they should be is like some kind of overview, so that even like fans of the band, let alone people who don't know who they are, could sort of see the whole story. And he goes, you should make that movie. And I said, yeah, I will. Oh, and then the gig happened. By the way, when we were having this discussion, we were standing in between Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols and Tony Basil of Hey Mickey, You're So Fine fame.
The first single I ever bought, along with Prince, When Doves Cry.
There you go. That's a good twofer. So I spent the gig, then the 90 minutes of the gig, thinking about it. And then that night, I said to Ronald Russell, said, hey, I want to talk to you about something. And then the next day I phoned him and said, well, has anybody ever approached you about doing a documentary? Because I think I'd like to do one. And it wasn't until that moment that I thought that I was going to make a documentary, full stop. And B, as soon as I'd said it out loud to them, I couldn't go back on that promise. So I said this to them without any idea of who might finance and make the movie.
Or what it would be, I guess, as well at that point, because that's the, you know, I've watched, like you said earlier, there are a lot of music documentaries out there, some good, some not so good, but this just feels like so really unique in terms of how you've worked the narrative, both in terms of visually putting yourself in there as well, you know, in terms of
I just want to say on record for the one or two reviews that said that I shouldn't have been on there, the only reason I was in it is because another director who shall remain nameless flaked and left us with 4 hours of studio time. So I said, well, you can interview me.
Oh, I think it's great that you're in it. Absolutely. Because I think that's the great thing, is you feel like you're on a journey with the band, almost as a fan of themselves in a weird way kind of thing. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, I just think it's, and there's so many great little elements to it as well in terms of the animation and the manga stuff and all that. I think it's such a great journey on this. Was it, how and what did you informed how you would tell their story?
Well, two things, and I want to answer your question from before, which I didn't, but like, in terms of the journey, that was the thing that was interesting about it, is because like a band like the Beatles, like, become immediately world famous in 1964. So everybody around the world in 63, 64 knows who the Beatles are. Sparks have a strange kind of like evolution, because even within their own success, they're not famous necessarily in the same country at the same time. Mm-hmm. And what I mean is that there's success in like the UK in the mid 70s and late 70s, and then success in the States, particularly in the West Coast, in the early 80s, when in the UK they had just sort of disappeared. They did not tour in the UK between 1975 and 1994. They did like a couple of TV appearances, like Wogan and TVAM and Top of the Pops in 1979, and that was kind of it. So what was interesting about that, and because around the time that I first thought of it, I'd been working both in London and Los Angeles. And so I had an idea, even before the documentary, of that Sparks means different things to different people. So that Sparks fans of a certain age be, oh my God, Kimona, my house, this town ain't big enough for the both of us on the Pops, or me, or somebody like Bernard Butler, who's around the same age as me, who remembers the same thing, remembers Beat the Clock or Number One in Heaven on Top of the Pops, you know, kind of too young to remember the mid-70s stuff. go to Los Angeles, and you mentioned Sparks today, oh my God, Angst in My Pants, a 1982 new wave album, one of my favorite albums of all time. They don't even necessarily know about the 70s stuff. So there was, this was a band that kind of were like, sort of like had pockets of success and influence in different places at different times. And I don't think even for me, it was really until when they came back in the mid 90s in the UK with When Do I Get to Sing My Way, which was on a lot of TV shows and they made TV appearances. And I was like, oh, wow, it's Sparks from same guys from 1979, you know, like the Beat the Clock guys. They're back and they look amazing. No, no use in lecturing them or in threatening them. They will just say, who are you? Is that a question or not? And you see that the plot is predictable, not new, but just as stunned at the things you will do. No, no use in taking their time or in wasting two dimes on a call to God knows who, when all you feel is the rain and it's hard to be vain when no person looks at you. So just be gracious and wait in the queue. I think that something like the internet, people forget how lucky they are that now they have an entire discography, maybe illegally for free at their fingertips. Not illegally, how should we put it? I'm just thinking about the broken record.
Equally.
Thing. Maybe the artist should be paid more for people having free discographies at their fingertips. Credit to #broken record. People don't know how lucky they are to have an entire discography at their fingertips or just be able to go on to Wikipedia or AllMusic and just read everything about an artist. Before then, in the before times, as we'll remember, is that you had to do a bit more detective work to figure out unless a band was really huge. Like, say a band like Sparks, before the internet, you would either have to rely on what was on the telly, on the radio, may or may not be in your local record shop, what may or may not be in a music magazine, mm-hmm. and what books might be in the library. Like in my library in Wells, Somerset, the only music book they had was the Guinness Book of Hit Singles. And so I could sort of look at the Sparks singles, but even that didn't tell the whole story. So it was something where, in that sense, the idea of the journey of the movie, what's kind of fun about it is that in different decades, it's different people and it kind of keeps on going. So it's like in the early 70s, there's like sort of Pamela Del Barres and Todd Rundgren. And then in the mid 70s, then sort of like Who's Watching at Home? Oh, it's the Sex Pistols and members of Joy Division and members of Squeeze. And then you come to the 80s and Who's Watching Now? It's Flea and it's Beck. And it just keeps on going and going and going, you know, right up until people like Jack Antonoff, who become a fan in the last 20 years, you know?
Yeah. I can't wait to go and see it again in cinema, actually, when it comes out. I think it warrants being seen on a big screen. I'm really looking forward to when it's released here in the UK and I can do that. And because there's so much music in the film as well, which is just so great, that highlights that kind of journey that you've just talked about.
Well, it was an important thing to say, actually. You know, if I have a bugbear about some music documentaries is that a lot of them assume prior knowledge.
Yeah.
That's okay if it's the Beatles and the Stones and Bob Dylan. But sometimes, and I don't want to mention any names of documentaries, I can think of at least two I saw recently where they were great documentaries, but if you didn't already know the songs, the films gave you no chance to fall in love with the songs or the artist. So with this, I was very conscious that, like, maybe if 8 out of 10 people don't know who Sparks are, is like, let them hear the songs, let them kind of like, let those songs burrow into their brain. So that was a really big part of it, was that sort of like, you know, you're going to cover 50 years of music through, yeah, you know, many different kind of genres and let people hear it. And that's always a fascinating thing to me, for people who are watching the film experiencing Sparks for the first time is what songs they take away as like, oh, you know, and it's interesting. I even asked that on social media for people who watched it, who didn't already know the band, what songs were stuck with you. And it's really sort of diverse list. It's not just the kind of the obvious big hits. It's like songs like My Baby's Taking Me Home, which is a brilliant track from Little Beethoven, which basically repeats the same lyrics throughout the entire song. And it's kind of a hypnotic, amazing anthem, you know?
I'm going to ask you another question, but if it looks like I'm moving, it's because I'm being thrown out of this meeting room at Soho House and I'm going to go and sit over the thing, but I'm going to put myself on mute whilst you answer it. I want to ask about their other film, because this is the great thing now that you've both got these two productions, you know, you've got the doc and then we've got film coming, I'm in Soho, and then you've got, and they've got the doc and Annette. You've seen Annette, tell me what your reaction to Annette is.
So when I first met Sparks for Coffee, they mentioned in passing, and I remember Ron Mayall said, oh, keep this under your hat, but we might be doing a movie musical with Leos Carax. And I was like, because I was a huge Leos Carax fan and I really loved Holy Motors, his previous movie. So I was like, oh my God, that sounds amazing. That sounds like a dream movie to have like Leos Carax and Sparks together. So that was 6 years ago. And what's amazing is that even as we went into production on the Sparks Brothers, Annette was not definitely being greenlit. So it's actually when I was shooting last night in Soho in the summer of 2019 that suddenly I got word that like Annette was happening and it was greenlit. And so as soon as I knew that it was kind of happening, I said to like our producers, said, hey, we got to go to Brussels and shoot on the set of Annette, which was actually the last bit of filming that I did for the movie, and also the last time I saw Ronald Russell in person, because then the pandemic hit.
I wanted to know if throughout the process you involved them, or whether it was a case of, obviously because you were on the road with them for times and with them for times to interview them and film them whilst they were playing, all that kind of stuff, but in terms of the process of making this film, did you involve them in that process, or did you want to kind of keep them slightly at arm's length?
You know what, and this actually answers the question that you asked before, which I forgot to answer. It's like, really, they let me kind of get on with it, in the sense of like, I had access to them. Like, I interviewed them, aside from following them around the world. So I went to Japan and Mexico and did stuff with them in LA and London, like four different kind of countries. And then I also did interviews in New York as well, and also interviewed them at length. I think the sort of the actual interviews with them must have been about 9 hours, because, you know, there's 50 years of stuff to talk about, more than 50 years of stuff to talk about. You know, and the only thing that they said, they let me kind of like, it's not like they were, sometimes you get on music documentaries that you have the artist be producers on the movie. And then sometimes you wonder kind of how, when it's that authorized, you wonder if there's kind of stuff that's been left out, you know. So to their credit to them, the only thing that they said to me early on, which I thought was, is that they didn't really want to talk about relationships, particularly like current ones. And I thought that's absolutely fair. And that sort of speaks to what you're saying before about, you know, how do you tell the whole story at Sparks, but let them remain enigmatic? Because like, they don't need to talk about their relationships or sexuality. It's not kind of like important that fans know that. And also, if anything, it kind of lets them be more inclusive in a way that, like, sort of that they don't have to kind of like sort of state anything really. So I think sort of fans actually like that aspect about them, you know. So if there's a thing where at the end of the movie that parts of their personal life are a bit of a question mark, I think that's exactly how Ron and Russell would like it. So, and to credit to them though, is that there are a couple of bits in the documentary where details about relationships do come through. And they're some of my favorite bits because they can't quite get through their diplomatic version of events without breaking. And it's one of my favorite bits in the documentary is when that happens, is where Russell has decided to talk about something in a very diplomatic way. And you can see Ron in the side of the screen sort of like smirking, saying, really? Like, and credit to them, they didn't ask me to take those bits out. I mean, there wasn't anything they asked me to cut. And, you know, the thing that they were really helpful with, apart from just access, was that there's a lot of archive that they had that, like, had, they're really good hoarders of their own stuff. So they had a ton of their own archive, including things like Russell's student film and, like, photos of them doing kind of, like, high school sports and stuff, which seeing Russell as a high school jock quarterback is quite amazing.
So weird.
What's also funny about Russell's student film, which is a French New Wave spoof called Très Sérieux, which he made at UCLA, is I saw that and I emailed Russ. I said, what's really crazy about this short is I made exactly the same short when I was 18 at art college. And I made a French New Wave spoof called Brainless, A Bout de Lemon Soufflé. And it was basically exactly the same movie. And I sent it to him, and we just thought that was hilarious that, like, decades apart, we'd basically done the same French New Wave spoof. I guess maybe every aspiring filmmaker makes a French New Wave spoof.
I think there needs to be a film festival that showcases all of those short films, for sure. Listen, I know we've got another film to look forward to from you, and I'm sorry about the noise in the background. There's a lot of, as you know, constant work going on in Soho, and because that's what we're going to talk about in the next episode when you have time, about your new film, which is going to be when's it coming out?
Comes out in the UK on October the 29th.
Amazing. Can you tell me anything?
I'll tell you that it's set in the modern day and in the 60s, and Thomasin McKenzie's character has grown up with her grandmother. Her mother is no longer with her. She's kind of with her grandmother, and because of that, her grandmother, who's played by Rita Tushingham in the movie, she's sort of inherited her 60s record collection. So it's that thing, because I was a little bit like this when I was a kid, is that, like, my parents' record collection, they seemed to stop buying records when they had me and my brother. They had sort of like a small but good collection of 60s records that seemed to stop with, like, Bridge Over Troubled Water in 1970, and then they didn't buy any other albums. Like, no, there were no, like, 70s albums at all. And so I used to kind of, like, listen to their records all the time because they didn't really listen to them anymore. So there's that weird thing of, like, I used to be a bit like that, where in the 80s and 90s I was listening to a lot of 60s and 70s music because I liked it, but B, it was something to sort of obsess about. And so I like this idea of having a character who, because she's grown up with her grandmother, has sort of, like, become obsessed with her record collection, which is from, like, you know, 60 years ago. So it's sort of the jumping off point, in a way, the music, to sort of take you back to that time. And in I guess in a way, there's that thing where a lot of people, myself included, have, like, time travel fantasies, or the fantasy of being in a previous decade. And I guess the sort of, like, the movie is that, in terms of, like, I can't travel back to the 60s, so making a film about them is, like, the closest thing. But everything comes with a price, and there's a care for what you wish for element to it as well, of course.
I can't wait to see it, and I can't wait to get to talk to you about that as well. And thank you for your patience today and for your time as well, Edgar. And huge congratulations on the doc. As I said, I can't wait to get back and see it in the cinema when it's out at the end of the month as well. It's nice to see you.
Thank you.
Bye.
When she's on her best behavior, don't be tempted by the favors. Never turn your back on mothers.
soundtrack to the Sparks Brothers, That's Never Turn Back on Mother Earth, rounding off this first part of Soundtracking with Edgar Wright. Next, it's the turn of Russell and Ron, with me to talk about both Edgar's documentary and their own movie, Annette, a musical about a stand-up comedian and an opera singer who have a child with a rare gift. Sounds wacky, but I loved it and highly recommend you see it as soon as you get the chance, which I think is going to be the first week of September. Now, before we hear from the boys, let's take in one of their songs from the film, All the Girls.
All the girls I see look so great to me. What amazes me is what they see in me. All the girls I see in France and Italy, or here in Roppongi, what do they see in me? Foreign guy, rich and drunk, maybe that's why.
Hard to imagine all these fucking men who hate themselves but want us to love them.
All the girls I see look so great to me, but will I ever be lovable again?
Thank you so much for taking the time though to do this. The documentary is so great. And it's, you know, I love music documentaries. And this just feels like something very new, very kind of creative, but so in keeping with you guys and the world of Sparks and kind of what you are about. It's got such creativity behind it. And then I wanted to ask, first of all, because I imagine there's been lots of requests for documentaries over the years to tell your story and to explore the journey that you've been on. What was it about Edgar's approach and his storytelling, and what, how did he sell it to you, and how, and what made you say yes?
There had been quite a few people coming up to us through the years wanting to make a documentary, and both because, you know, we weren't really comfortable with what these people might have done just in a filmic way. And also just we in a general sense, we felt that a documentary wasn't necessary, that what we do musically kind of says as much as needs to be said about us. But Edgar had come to a couple of our concerts in Los Angeles several years back. And after the second one, he approached us about doing a documentary, and, you know, partially because it was Edgar Wright and we really loved his films, but also just his kind of saying that he wanted in the documentary to not just focus on some mythic period in the past of ours, but that he felt that what we were doing even now was as strong as anything we've ever done. So that kind of approach was kind of, it's kind of how we feel about ourselves, you know, whether it's right or wrong, other people can judge, but we're never kind of nostalgic when we're thinking about what we're doing. And so, you know, we said yes to Edgar where we didn't say yes to anybody else. And we have faith in him as a filmmaker. And, you know, our only fear was just that when we did go ahead with this, that maybe since he only has done narrative films before this, that his first documentary with us being the recipients would be kind of his one boring film, but it turned out to be far from that. I mean, he put in all the Edgar Wright touches, but in a documentary form. And so we were thrilled both stylistically, but also just the content of it, that it was up to date.
Because he's coming at it as a fan as well, and he puts himself in the film. I love that, because, and he very much makes it a fan film in a way that he involves so many fans of your journey throughout the years. That must have been lovely for you to, you know, because you said, Ron, that you don't look back, you don't kind of it's all about kind of what's next sort of thing. But to actually allow yourself to take a moment to hear from fans, be they you know, all over the world or famous faces, to hear their influence and their inspiration and their love for what you guys have done over the years, must have been lovely to actually allow yourself to acknowledge and listen.
It was amazing. You know, it was really amazing to just be able to hear all of those great people from different creative walks of life. You know, we had no idea that, you know, people like Mike Myers would even have heard of Sparks, let alone would be able to recite lyrics and analyze them from one of our old albums, and the writer Neil Gaiman talking about album cover artwork of ours in such a, you know, in such an eloquent way, and varied musicians from, you know, Flea of the Chili Peppers speaking really articulately about one of the lesser known Sparks albums, introducing Sparks and saying, you know, how much he loved that album. And then just the musicians were all from just such disparate kind of genres, you know, from Vince Clarke to the Sex Pistols, you know, and everything kind of in between. So it was really, you know, heartwarming to us to see that there were these people from different creative areas speaking so eloquently about Sparks. It's just, you know, amazing. And especially like you mentioned, Edgar just being such a, you know, a great fan of the band, and his kind of his enthusiasm just sort of exudes off the screen all of the time. So, it, you know, it's really amazing for us. Yeah.
I think it's really lovely because he's almost allowed that enthusiasm and genuine love for what you do to inspire his creativity within the film. And that's influenced, you know, the format of the film and what he's used, be that turning you into kind of manga characters and all that kind of stuff, and the wonderful visual way that he's chosen to tell this story.
Just before even doing the documentary, there was some overlap in our sensibilities. And so that it was fortunate enough, it wasn't a stretch for either him or us to have the documentary be the way it was, because both of us are kind of leaning a certain direction in what we do, just kind of a really kinetic approach to things, and kind of an anything can work as long as it's done the right way within either a film or music. So it was a comfortable fit through the whole process.
Russell, were you going to pick up on something there on the back? Sorry.
No.
Okay.
I forgot what I was going to say, but
don't worry.
I think I covered it.
Were you part of the process throughout the whole making of the doc, or did you, you know, obviously he was with you on going to different parts of the world and being part of the film and, you know, in terms of being interviewed and things, but did he keep you informed of what he was doing and when, or how did that work?
Well, we have so much faith in Edgar as a film director that, you know, normally in Sparks, we're our own bosses, and we can kind of dictate exactly what we want to have happen. And we, you know, and we do that, you know, gladly. And it's the only way, you know, we work more undemocratically in a certain way. But with, you know, when it's a film, we've learned on both projects, obviously, when you're working on a film, you're entrusting your work to another person, but you're doing that, you know, hopefully willingly, because you're a fan of their work and you know what they do creatively. So both with Annette and obviously with the documentary, we're just such fans of Edgar's work that we kind of wanted to stay out of the process. He obviously let us know along the way who we'd be interviewing and things like that. And like you mentioned, he came with us all around the world, to Mexico City, to London, Tokyo, Los Angeles, filming us. So he and his team became kind of a part of our lives for the 3 years of filming of the documentary. So, you know, but it's all a question of trust. And we had 100% trust in Edgar and his films. And like Ron had mentioned from the beginning, we just hoped it would be as carrying the Edgar Wright stamp as much as any of his other films, that it wasn't going to be a, you know, this was be the one outlier, be the dull, boring documentary, but in fact, it did have all of the signature marks of his on it.
Yeah, it's so bizarre. I'm in a hotel room above what used to be the old BBC studios, where you would have been on Top of the Pops, which is a lovely synchronicity, considering it's in the film as well, which is how we were introduced to. Well, I was introduced to you as a wee girl from Scotland who is, you know, interested in music and finding ways of telling stories through music as well. And that's what I've always loved about your music, is your storytelling, is how you kind of create these worlds with every album. And like you said, you mentioned the artwork, and it's this whole package of the visuals, be that the artwork or watching you perform on, whether it's, you know, on TV, but and then the music and the characters and the stories that you create within that. What inspires you both?
Well, it never really is a specific thing, unless there's like, you need to have an album done now. That kind of thing. But there isn't really an inspiration that kind of causes us to want to go into the studio, or even an incident that kind of makes you want to write a song. I mean, it's just a general passion we have to do what we're doing. There isn't any kind of, you know, force other than just kind of an internal desire to do it, because, you know, we realize we're in a different position than almost any other band at this stage of having so many albums, where we're able to kind of honestly do pop music without it being kind of toned down and kind of self-reflective. And so we just want to see how far we can push things, and, you know, just working both within the song, traditional song structures, and then also on longer narrative musical film in that kind of way. You know, we just have a passion just to do it. There isn't any kind of specific thing. I mean, we're lucky that we have that, and we're lucky that we haven't lost that, and we hope that we never do.
I was lucky enough to watch Annette last night, and I had, as I said, the most beautiful experience watching that film. I was just in awe of it. It was such a gorgeous journey to go on. What inspired that?
Well, we had done, quite a few years ago, we had done another narrative project called The Seduction of Ingmar Bergman, and we'd done that for the Swedish National Radio, and we really enjoyed the process of doing something that wasn't in a traditional Sparks album format, that was something more expansive and told an actual story. So we weren't able to tour with that. We wanted to actually tour it. We played one performance of it at the Los Angeles Film Festival a long time ago, but we weren't able to tour with it. So we came up with another idea that involved a fewer number of characters. And we thought this would be Sparks' next album 9 years ago. And it was something that we were going to go on tour with, actually. Ron would play the conductor character. I would play the stand-up comedian character that Adam Driver portrays. And we would bring along an extra, a female opera singer who would do the role that Marianne Cotillard is doing. Then 8 years ago, we came to Cannes, where we are right now, and we met Leos Carax, who had used one of our songs in his last film, Holy Motors. And we wanted to thank him for doing that. And we really love his films and thought there's a real kindred spirit in what he does cinematically to what Sparks does with our music. And so when we got back to LA, we said, oh, we should just send this project to Leos, expecting nothing, but more just because he's a fan of the band and wanting to, you know, keep him up to date about what we're doing.
What was his reaction when you sent it to him initially? What did he just kind of get back and go, let's make a film?
Well, not immediately. He you know, he's generally, even if he's based any of his films on outside material, he's written all his films. So we sent it to him, and he said, this is really interesting. Let me think about this for a couple of weeks. And so he thought about it, and the story had some kind of connection to him personally, as well as, you know, just in a creative kind of way. So he got back to us after a couple of weeks and said, I'd really like to direct this film, you know, with kind of the provision that him being a very personal director, he would want to add some personal elements of,
yeah,
of this to the work. But in general, it kind of is what it was even nine years ago. I mean, there are a couple of pieces that were added at his request. And then there's some of the lyrics that are slightly altered, but in general, it, you know, the pieces are basically what was there nine years ago. So, you know, it's taken a long time. You know, he came to LA quite a few times. We went to Paris quite a few times, just kind of slightly tweaking things because he he's an amazing filmmaker and he just wants, and he doesn't make a lot of films. And so he wants them to all be exact. And so, and then, you know, they're always kind of hitches along the way with financing of any film, but it all came together. And, you know, the cast is so brilliant. Both Adam and Marianne and Simon as well are just incredible in the film. And we had a discussion about 5 years ago with Adam. You know, it's you kind of are kind of thinking, well, what position am I in to be able to tell Adam Driver how to do anything, you know? But we had a discussion just about the style of the singing. And and that was like a key thing because we didn't want the film to be Broadway-esque in kind of way, like that all the singing had to be kind of naturalistic and toned down. And also that there wouldn't be any traditional choreography in the film. But Adam, you know, it's difficult because we lived with Russell singing it for so long. So you kind of think, is this going to work at all with any, but, you know, he was able to do not mimicking what Russell did, but kind of a parallel universe kind of
yeah,
what that part was. And so we were thrilled with what he did.
We love each other. Each other so much. We're scoffing at logic. This wasn't the plan. We love each other so much.
We love each other.
Not knowing the kind of backstory in terms of how it was written, I watching the film, you can't imagine any other actors being in those roles because what they bring to them is just extraordinary. Adam's presence and the intensity of that relationship. And like you say, it's you kind of forget that they're singing sometimes because you're so in it with them. You're on this incredible journey and such a fan of Marion's as well, and it's so great to see her in a role like this. You know, I love the Levion Rose when she played Edith Piaf, and to see her kind of to kind of step back on that stage as well, it's a real joy to watch.
Yeah, I mean,
so emotional.
The chemistry between the two of them was amazing, and you know that, you know, what you mentioned about kind of forgetting that they're singing, I mean, that I think is it isn't diminishing the impact of the music.
No, not at all.
To us, it's like enhancing the emotions of everything. I mean, one touchstone for us as far as not even doing something in the style of that, but just the effect of it was the Jacques Demy, the Umbrellas of Cherbourg, where it's kind of wall-to-wall singing, but done in settings where after a while you do kind of forget that it's being sung and people singing it while they're working on cars and all of that. And so stylistically, it has no resemblance to that, but just as far as what a movie musical can be, that was more of what we were going after rather than a, you know, kind of a Hollywood musical. And so, you know, we couldn't have been happier with all the performances. And, you know, just Leo's character is so brilliant. And he hasn't made that many films, and for him to focus, through the whole process, he didn't have like 10 projects going on, you know, at the same time or thinking about. He was focused on this one thing. And I think that was the key to the part of the strength of the final film, just his focus.
I think it's theatrical background, because he's obviously got such a strong connection with the theatre. He's brought so much of that to this role. Was there much kind of on those, on particularly with Adam, in those stand-up scenes as well, you know, that there are little musical interludes within part of that, and it looks so natural, it looks so responsive to the audience, to his movement, to his emotion. Was all that scripted, or was there encouragement for him to improvise in any way with that sort of side of it?
The first monologue was more scripted out and is more similar to the original version we had. And the second monologue was, Leos had a lot of input into that. And a lot of it was letting Adam kind of do his thing for the second monologue, especially. So that was one piece in particular that, you know, for, there was a decision was made by Leos to have it be less of a musical scene and more of a, you know, more letting Adam just do his thing. So it's kind of an outlier within the film, but it's it's really extraordinary kind of acting that Adam brings to those scenes. And like you mentioned, throughout the film, he's just kind of a pretty astounding in a role that we can't remember any role of his being as kind of intense as that role that he has in this film. So
I think we've all seen his brilliant ability as a performer, but this kind of just, it lays it all out on a plate, kind of, you know, it's like a cordon bleu chef's best meal. It's like, oh yes, this is extraordinary. And the songs are so catchy. I have been singing So May We Start, like, for the past 24 hours, like, in my head. I kind of woke up this morning feeling like I'd kind of woken up in, you know, kind of, I was like, I almost wanted to start my day by singing it.
One, two. So may we start. So may we start. It's time to start. My time to start. They hope that it goes the way it's supposed to go. There's fear in them all, but they can't let it show. They're under. Budget is large, but still, it's not enough.
So may we start.
May we start. May we not start.
So may we start.
May we start. May we not start.
It's time to start.
May we start. May we not start.
My time to start.
May we start. May we not start.
You've created a fantastic collection and a real array of styles as well within this. Even though this is a musical film, there are lots of different musical textures to these songs that you've created for the film. Was that the intent?
Well, we just, through all that we've done in all of our albums, we've kind of gone through so many different styles on those that we have a lot of tools that we can draw on, and we didn't want to, you know, you never know how many times you can get a movie musical made. So we didn't want to hold anything back, put in everything that we knew. And, you know, the song, So May We Start, it was the film, was the opening film at the Cannes Film Festival. And kind of the first thing that anybody here heard was the song, So May We Start. And it almost became like a unofficial anthem for the whole festival. It really seemed inspiring to people in a more general way than just the opening piece of Annette. So, you know, it was really touching for us.
Before we run out of time, I wanted to quickly ask about the character of Annette. I mean, I don't want to talk about it in any great detail, really, because I don't want to spoil anything for people who want to go into the film. So I don't know if there is a way of you talking about the character in a way that doesn't give much away. It's really hard.
Yeah, well, Annette is the child of this famous couple, Adam Driver's character, who is a famous stand-up comedian whose career is sort of taking a bit of a downturn, and he's married to now, surprisingly married to a world-renowned opera singer that's Marianne Cotillard's role, and her career is sort of really blossoming while his is kind of on the way down. And so the two of them have this child, and like you said, without giving away too much, the child eventually inherits this unique ability that was sort of handed down to her from her mother. And sort of once that starts to happen, the things in the film also start to get into a situation that it's things start to tumble fast for the two characters. And then the young child is the one that's sort of this bridge between the two parents in a certain way. But yeah, it's hard to talk too much about it without giving it, but hopefully that left it pretty vague.
But I think it's such a clever way of, I think the way that the child is portrayed is so, it's so clever. It's so unique, and it's really thoughtful as well.
A lot of that has to do with Leos, because he really took a chance on the way that Annette is portrayed in the film. And the naturalistic way that all the actors react to Annette is just a sign of some amazing acting.
Yeah. You've had this flirtation with films in the past, and we Edgar goes into that within the documentary, which is a really interesting part, and you know, a journey that you really wanted to take that didn't come to fruition. But this wonderful synergy of these two films that we get to enjoy, and I really hope that this is the first of many, many films that you're able to make, because it's really something special, and it's so different as well. It's like nothing I've ever, it's like so many of my favorite experiences at cinema kind of coming together. Well, you must feel very happy that this world has finally happened. You know, you've finally got the opportunity to do it.
Yeah, we are in a certain way. Amongst Edgar's many theses in the documentary, one, I think he feels really vindicated that as a result of a couple of past flirtations with movie projects that didn't come to light, that now he's able to say and show in the documentary that, aha, see, with perseverance and, just a lot of fortunate circumstances, that in the end, we kind of, we're all vindicated, and we have the opening film at the Cannes Film Festival. And I think Edgar was really just really ecstatic that happened. And, you know, and like you mentioned, you wondered about that, this won't be the last movie musical project. We're actually working on a new one. So just energized by this experience, and also by the, you know, just the reaction to Annette and to the documentary. And so we're now have started another project. So there will be one in the future, as well as a new Sparks album. We're kind of the new Sparks album as well. So
brilliant. Amazing. Ron and Russell, thank you so much for your time. It really is a genuine treat to get to chat to you. And thank you for allowing Edgar to tell your story, and also for this beautiful, beautiful film, and hope to see you in person soon at some point. Thank you so much. Take care.
Bye. True love always follows.
True love always follows.
From the soundtrack to Annette, that's True Love Always Finds a Way. Rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with Edgar Wright and the Sparks Brothers, Russell and Ron. My huge thanks to all three of those fine gentlemen for taking the time to talk to me. Sparks Brothers is in cinemas now. Please go and see it. It is highly entertaining. Whether you are a massive Sparks fan or whether you don't really know that much about them, it is fabulous. Edgar's done a great job. You'll also be able to watch Annette when it comes out. I think it's the first week of September, the 3rd of September. Highly recommend that too. Head to edithbowman.com to catch up with all of our previous episodes of the podcast, including my two previous conversations with Edgar. You'll also be able to link to Spotify playlists for every single show in which we list the songs in the order they appear. All that can be found at edithbowman.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram and Twitter. We are at Soundtracking UK, and keep your eyes out on our YouTube channel for shows I put together with guests from the podcast and some others, well, who don't quite fit in. I'm going to actually stick up Kate Herron and Natalie Holt from last week because we got such a great response to them on the show that I just wanted to share our chat with you visually because we filmed it together in the same room at a place called Spirit Land in King's Cross. Massive thanks to Chris, our engineer there, for filming that for us. So I'll stick that up on the YouTube channel in the next few days. Next up, now this is slightly big news for us because next week we are kind of round about that date celebrating our fifth anniversary. We have been making this podcast for 5 years. Ben, can you believe it? It's extraordinary, really. I can't quite believe it myself because we started this, Ben and I, as a passion project. We wanted to start a conversation about music and film. And so we decided to launch this podcast. And thanks to you guys and your continued support and the support of all of our guests who have appeared and hopefully who will appear on the show, we genuinely couldn't do it without you. And we started this show, episode one, back in August 2016 with Mr. Ben Wheatley, who we are eternally grateful for his support throughout the years on this podcast. So much so that next week on the show, he returns for a fifth sitting. Woohoo! But he's also joined by his producer partner, Andy Stark. So to celebrate our fifth birthday next week on the show, Ben Wheatley returns and his producing partner, Andy Stark, to talk about the film that they made in COVID. Ah, oh, so good, In the Earth. Ben Wheatley, Andy Stark, celebrating our fifth birthday next week on the show. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.